From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, the plight of Syrian refugees. Our guest, Reva Dhingra, research fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. That's a prominent think tank based in Washington. She recently wrote an article entitled Syrian Refugees Face a Grim Future Without International Policy Shifts. And here is a quote from that article. Quote, 12 years after the 2011 uprisings and subsequent civil war began, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has kept his hold on power through a strategy of civilian targeting, siege tactics, and countless other war crimes. At least 350,000 civilians have been killed, and the majority of the country's population has been displaced, including over 6.8 million as refugees. Yet even as refugees have built new lives abroad, most Syrians in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, the main regional hosting countries, are economically and socio-politically marginalized to different degrees. The poverty rate for refugees in the region is over 70% and is being aggravated by worsening domestic economic crises. Politicization of the refugee presence in each country has left many Syrians with tenuous legal statuses and prevented permanent integration. Efforts by the Assad regime to normalize regional diplomatic relations, accelerated after that devastating February 6 Turkey-Syria earthquakes, are raising fears of mass forced refugee returns. Close quote. In addition, we note that on May 7, the Arab League agreed to reinstate Syria, ending a 12-year suspension, another step toward bringing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad back into the fold after Syria's membership was suspended during that country's 2011 uprising against the Assad government, a conflict, as we have said, has killed nearly 500,000 people. We will talk with Reva Dhingra about her research on the plight of Syrian refugees within the context of Syria's reinstatement in the Arab League, Lebanese politics, and to what extent the outcome of the upcoming Turkish elections may affect the fate of the many Syrian refugees in that country. And Reva Dhingra joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you, Reva, on this most timely topic, particularly in light of the Arab League's reinstatement of Syria. Let me ask you that question first off, in fact. What effect do you think Syria's reinstatement in the Arab League may have on the status of refugees?
Yeah, so this weekend's decision, the unanimous vote by member states to, with the exception of Qatar, which didn't send a representative to the meeting, to reinstate Syria into the Arab League represents the culmination of months and years of efforts led by Jordan and the UAE to essentially bring Assad back into the fold. And the concrete implications for refugees in the immediate term are a little unclear because it's not yet known what tangible effect this will have on the main issues preventing Syrians from returning, which are safety and security, on reconstruction, on a lack of livelihoods in Syria. And what this does mean, however, is that it's opening a door to further negotiations, to further cooperation between Arab states, and the possibility that refugees could be returned even if tangible improvements don't happen on the ground in terms of safety and security to welcome them back. So what we're seeing right now is essentially Arab member states making a decision to normalize diplomatic relations with the Syrian government without there being much clarity on what they're getting in return in terms of practical plans for refugees to go back, practical plans to create the conditions to ensure refugees can go back. And the main issue that it's raising is the sort of idea that there may be forced returns in the future.
Indeed, that prospect of forced returns must really strike great fear in the minds of the refugees. Just very quickly, what's your reaction in general to the Arab League's decision? Is it a sense of they really don't know what else to do? They're not really embracing him per se, but the isolation and spurning of the country wasn't working, evidently.
Yeah, and I would say that this movement and other observers have noted that this movement really came about as a result of two main issues. First, refugees, but even more importantly, the drug trade. So Syria's main producer of Captagon, which is a stimulant that is making its way throughout the Gulf region through Jordan and essentially across the region and creating serious policy challenges. Syria has over the past decade become a central hub for the production and export of Captagon. So stemming the Captagon trade has been a key policy priority, especially of Jordan, which has been driving a lot of the normalization efforts in recent years and of Gulf countries. And I think there's a sort of perception that expanding relations with the Assad government could help these governments tackle the two main challenges, as well as, you know, regional safety and security. There's also discussion of countering the influence of Iran. But what's unclear in all of this and in the statement made is what Arab states are actually getting for the number of concessions that they seem to have made over the past few months. It's not clear that any of these policy priorities are going to be translating into action. So what Assad is doing in return for these expanded connections remains to be seen.
Indeed, it does. And I'm going to now quote Reva from The Economist magazine, quote, "No one should be too hopeful." That is about Syria's reentry into the Arab League and what it could portend. "Some in the sprawling Syrian diaspora have built decent lives in their adopted countries, while others are consigned to squalor, living in tents and surviving on handouts. Almost none of them, however, wish to return permanently to a country where their homes were destroyed, their lands confiscated, their livelihoods ruined. They are unlikely to go back, at least not by choice, unless the regime makes both political reforms and progress on reconstruction," unquote. And that doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, no, it doesn't look like that at all. I would completely agree with that quote. And we have plenty of survey data with Syrians that show, you know, for example, UNHCR had a 2021 survey on intention to return, where less than 2% of Syrian refugees said that they intended to return within the next 12 months to Syria, and less than 30% within the next 5 years. And the main reason cited was lack of safety and security, as well as, you know, the general economic and infrastructural situation. So the immense amount of destruction, home theft that many refugees have experienced. So a lot of properties were actually seized by the Syrian government or affiliated groups from refugees who had left their homes. And, you know, a fear of arrest, detention, political repression, forced conscription for men into the army. And the question is, even if host governments are implementing these policy changes, are trying to normalize relations with Syria, you can't make Syrians want to return to a country that isn't safe, that doesn't have the infrastructural facilities, the services, or the economic conditions for them to safely return to.
Exactly right. And this is going to be a major predicament. Let's go to where many of these Syrians are living now, Reva, and you're very familiar with that, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, and describe a bit the situation in each of those countries, how they differ, and the numbers of refugees in these various places.
So the main regional refugee hosting countries, as you've noted, are Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. There are also refugees in Egypt and Iraq, but they're smaller numbers than in Lebanon and Jordan and Turkey. So Turkey is the region's biggest refugee hosting country. It's actually the biggest refugee hosting country in the world, and it currently has over 3.4 million registered Syrian refugees. And I use the term registered because there are refugees who are registered with UNHCR, which is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. But then there are refugees who are not actually registered with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees because, for example, in Lebanon, they stopped registering refugees after 2016, and they're actually now embarking on a campaign of deportations of people who aren't registered, even though they were the ones who stopped registering Syrian refugees. But to return to Turkey, Turkey has gotten progressively worse as anti-refugee rhetoric has increased among both citizens and the political parties. So initially, Erdogan's government welcomed refugees, gave them access to services, and even up to 200,000 refugees got citizenship. However, there's been increasing anti-refugee sentiment among the population, and opposition parties have capitalized on this sentiment and fueled it further as part of their election campaigning. So there's a competition between political parties to see who can propose the fastest timeline for encouraging, in air quotes, but forcing refugees to return home. So one party will propose 3 years, and the other one will propose 2 years, and then others will propose, you know, within a year after their election. But essentially, the opposition bloc is sort of united around a goal of, in their rhetoric, they say voluntary returns, but returning the Syrian refugees within the country to Syria and also normalizing relations further with the Syrian government. And Erdogan as well has shifted his rhetoric within the past couple of years from a stance of welcoming refugees to also promising to return up to 1 million refugees within the next 2 years. So in general, the situation in Turkey has gotten pretty tense for refugees. And will, unfortunately, after the elections, there's really no telling right now whether those plans will actually translate into reality. It would be extremely practically difficult to repatriate that number of like millions of people to Syria, but that is the sort of general promise that's been made by politicians in both the opposition and Erdogan himself. So I'll talk about Lebanon now. And Lebanon, I mean, it's an incredibly awful situation. The country has been experiencing economic collapse since 2019. It's been essentially in a state of complete political gridlock, and refugees are being scapegoated in this scenario. So politicians in the country's sectarian-based political system are basically fueling anti-refugee sentiment, fueling the perception that refugees are stealing aid, that refugees are receiving aid that Lebanese should be receiving, and that they are a drain on the state resources without taking responsibility for the consequences of their own political decision-making. In Lebanon, politicians have scapegoated the Syrian refugees in the country for the consequences of their own inability to effectively manage the country's economy and political system. In recent months, they've embarked on a wave of forced deportations. They have adopted increasingly anti-refugee rhetoric and essentially blamed refugees for, you know, diverting aid, for receiving aid that Lebanese citizens aren't getting, and saying that the economic conditions of the country are Syrian refugees' fault. And unfortunately, this has translated into pretty severe economic and social exclusion for refugees. So over 9 out of 10 refugees are living in poverty. You see high rates of child labor and child marriage. And in general, the economic situation and social situation of Syrian refugees in Lebanon is getting worse with each year, especially as the overall economic situation in the country worsens and the government adopts increasingly hostile policies towards refugees. There are interviews and speaking to colleagues who have been in Lebanon recently. That's not translating necessarily into more people being willing to return to Syria. It actually means that people are afraid to come out of their houses or are more interested in migrating to Europe, for example.
This is just a horrendous situation.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking at refugees, Syrian refugees, who have suffered so much and now are suffering again at the hands of their so-called hosts, being scapegoated for things that they're not responsible for. But we'll have more about that in just a moment. You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Reva Dingra. She's a research fellow in foreign policy at the Washington-based Brookings Institution. I'm Carol Castiel. We are discussing the predicament of Syrian refugees. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners and Facebook fans, Ibrahim Abba from the great state of Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Reva Dingra. We were talking about the plight of Syrian refugees just a moment ago in Lebanon, how they're being scapegoated. The Lebanese political situation is certainly a mess in its own right, but this just compounds the Syrians' predicament. Talk about now Jordan, Reeva. We've talked about Turkey, the politics there, the fact that the upcoming elections may very well affect the plight of the refugees. Both sides are talking about repatriating these refugees to an unknown fate in Syria. What's the situation in Jordan?
Jordan has been leading many of the normalization efforts with the Syrian government, but actually, the number of refugees that have returned from Jordan to Syria are very small. So Jordan has approximately 660,000 registered Syrian refugees. It's said that it has as many as 1.2 million. But again, these numbers are really hard to pin down given the different registration statuses of Syrians in different countries. And Jordan has had longstanding cooperation with Western governments, and in 2016 signed the Jordan-EU Compact in an attempt to foster economic inclusion, give more work permits to Syrian refugees in exchange for trade concessions from the West for Jordanian businesses, specifically in different economic zones within the country. But unfortunately, a lot of these efforts haven't necessarily translated into better economic opportunities or social inclusion for Syrians. So while Syrians in Jordan aren't necessarily meeting the same hostility from the government in terms of the political rhetoric that you see in Turkey and in Lebanon, you still have extremely high poverty rates among Syrians who live outside of camp settings. Most Syrians in Jordan live in urban areas, and a general economic marginalization, unfortunately reflecting Jordan's overall struggles with employment, has high unemployment rates among its own population. And because refugees don't necessarily have access to the same work sectors that the rest of the population does, a lot of refugees are either working informally or for lower wages than Jordanian citizens. But Jordan has also embarked on forced deportations of some Syrians, but not to the degree that Lebanon and Turkey have. And while they are driving these normalization efforts, I haven't heard anything saying that they're intending to repatriate refugees anytime soon.
I'd like to go back to the original sin, so to speak, Reeva Dingra, and that is the fact that we have to look back at the West's inaction when Bashar al-Assad attacked his own people in 2011 when they were innocently protesting for greater democratization within the context of the Arab Spring uprisings. We have to recall that the West's inaction to some extent created this refugee crisis because they did not intervene to stop Bashar al-Assad when they could have. And we all recall they capitulated, or rather the United States in this case, did a deal with Russia when Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons on his own people. And the West considered, that is the French and the United States, thought about bombing the runways of Damascus, but instead decided to take this so-called deal to remove chemical weapons with Russia being the broker. I'm not really sure, you know, if those chemical weapons have been fully removed, but the fact of the matter is that really saved Bashar al-Assad. And of course, Russians went in 2015, big time, with help from Iran and Hezbollah. We all know the story. So it didn't stop Bashar al-Assad from using barrel bombs on his own people, chlorine gas. I guess I'm trying to paint a picture of the West inaction has to lead to some accountability for what we're looking at right now with these refugees. To what extent is the West responsible for, in fact, the plight of these refugees now, as we see countries, host countries like Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, trying to repatriate some? And how should we hold the West? What should the West be doing, the UN, international and multilateral agencies, to work on this, just as Bashar al-Assad, who hasn't changed his stripes, is being welcomed back into the Arab League fold?
Yeah, Carol, and I think that's a really interesting observation on this. When the discussions of the red line were happening around chemical weapons, there was this sort of lack of appetite from both the administration and I think probably a well-founded perception from the American public on intervention. There was this idea that after Libya and after the Iraq War, that intervention in Syria would be a bridge too far. And In the aftermath of that sort of red line passed with relatively little consequences for the Syrian government, you saw Russia become involved in the war and start piloting many of the tactics that it's used in Ukraine. So this is a discussion that many in the Syrian refugee space and people who work on Syria have raised time and time again, is we should have known this was coming because Russia perfected these tactics in Syria. They use Syria as a training ground for barrel bombing, for civilian infrastructure targeting, for hospital targeting, for the targeting of bread lines, and really adopt a scorched earth approach to Syria and has now used those tactics in Ukraine. And I think it would be unthinkable for people to say that Ukrainians should return to territories that are being actively controlled by Russia or where they would be faced with the threat of arrest, of forced conscription, for example, in the Russian army. It would be unthinkable for us to say that Ukrainians should do such a thing. And I think in the Syrian context, because it's a civil war, because there is a sort of perception that there are no good actors on any side, that the opposition was fractured, and that there's also the dynamic of it's not a Western country. It is a country in the Middle East, and there are dynamics at play there as well that we don't have the same appetite for political pressure and diplomatic pressure that we do in other contexts. So I think, yeah, unfortunately, people will be looking back at the 2013 to 2017 period in particular and thinking about what could have been done. I don't know if we'll have a good answer on military intervention. I think that looking at how Libya went will always be something that people will think about as well. But what I do think can be done now is looking at U.S. support for a political solution, multilateral support for, you know, if refugees do want to return to certain areas of Syria, making sure that reconstruction funding is not being stolen by the Assad government, which unfortunately a lot of humanitarian aid has, and putting pressure on allies to not forcibly return refugees, to keep assistance portfolios high. And as I wrote about in my article, look for more creative solutions to promoting refugee inclusion and displacement. So that means increasing resettlement of refugees who would face particular harm and individual threats if, you know, return to Syria or are facing similar threats in their host country. It would be expanding labor visa pipelines, expanding economic pipelines, and it would be investing in economic development and creating, you know, more economic opportunities for the whole population within host countries such as Turkey and Jordan. And I would add Lebanon, though unfortunately Lebanon is its own problem and the government there has not seemed amenable at all to any sort of investment that would require it to change from its pattern of corruption. But my colleagues here at Brookings have written about a Turkey compact, for example, that would bring in reconstruction support in exchange for including refugees after the earthquakes, in exchange for including refugees in work permit programs and in reconstruction. So there are a lot of things. And, you know, I have to remain optimistic. Colleagues have to remain optimistic on what we can still do to make sure that refugees and people inside Syria are protected.
And you say in your paper, Reva, that research shows that, quote, refugees contribute to local economies and attract international support for local development, and that in 2019, 78% of refugees were displaced for longer than 5 years. I'm sure you're referring to the Syrians. Refugees become long-term members of the communities, you know, whether they are met with supportive policies or not. So many of these, particularly in Turkey, you know, are part and parcel of the Turkish landscape. And my question would be to the Turks, you know, how are you going to decide whom to repatriate? And then once again, probably the most impoverished are probably going to be the ones that they would repatriate to an uncertain fate in Syria. That's my concern.
So that 78% number is actually of all refugees. So for all refugees globally in 2019, it's 78% of refugees. And this is a reality that we've seen time and time again in other refugee crises and other refugee presences across the globe. And I think the question facing governments and facing, you know, donors as well is, do we want to adopt policies that push people into the shadows, that push people into long-term situations of insecurity and instability, and ultimately create more security issues and more stability and human development issues for both host countries and origin countries if we're pushing people back? Or do we want to adopt evidence-based policies that support refugees and host communities in displacement and that help people by giving them the tools to succeed, by giving them economic development programs, by supporting interventions that reduce social tensions and that ultimately bring the whole society up together?
Yes, that would be ideal. But the refugee problem, beyond just the Syrian refugees who are, you know, the most poignant example of the plight of refugees, is an international one. In many ways, there are migratory trends, and that's perfectly normal, but so many are fleeing conflict, depredations like the Syrians. So we just can't sit back because the consequences of doing so are really unthinkable and would have very adverse consequences, both in the short and long run. But one more question on Syria itself. Bashar al-Assad does not control all of Syrian territory, does he? And I was just wondering, in terms of repatriating Syrians at some point, there are certainly areas where they should never go, or perhaps there's areas which are more conducive, would you say?
Yeah, and I think that unfortunately gets at the reality of Syria right now, which even in so-called government controlled territories, what you actually see is a sort of patchwork of different actors controlling different parts of the territory. So, for example, Turkey controls up to 10% of northern Syria. So, yeah, it's a very patchy local landscape with different degrees of security threats.
Reva Dengra is a research fellow in foreign policy at the Washington-based Brookings Institution. Reva, thank you so much for your excellent insights on the plight of Syrian refugees. We greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Carol.
Before we close, here is an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government about the dangerous situation in northern Syria.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Northern Syria is currently the home of some 10,000 former ISIS fighters, the largest concentration of terrorists in the world. About 5,000 of them are Syrians, 3,000 Iraqis, and 2,000 are foreign fighters from 60 countries outside of Syria and Iraq. Most of these men were captured by the Syrian Democratic Forces with support by the Coalition to Defeat ISIS in early 2019. As ISIS tried and failed to hold on to the town of Baghouz, its last foothold in Syria. Today, these men live in the Al-Hol detention camp on the outskirts of the town of the same name. Living with them in Al-Hol and another camp, the Raj facility, are their families, around 56,000 noncombatants, including young children, some of whom were born in the detention facilities. These people are waiting to be repatriated to their home countries. However, although the rate of repatriation has picked up over the past year or so, the home countries of these detainees are often unwilling or slow to take back their citizens. Those detainees who were allowed to return home were mostly women and children. While repatriation of women and children is important and urgent, the hard truth is that countries must also repatriate men and youth in detention and rehabilitation centers, said Ian Moss, the U.S. State Department's deputy coordinator for counterterrorism with responsibility for terrorist detention and countering violent extremism. We hear time and time again leaders say their domestic publics are opposed to repatriation. They argue that the fighters, if they are successfully prosecuted, could risk radicalizing prison populations. They also express concern that returnees who are unable to be prosecuted could plan future terrorist attacks or promote violence. There is indeed a risk of radicalization to violence and recidivism, but the alternative, a possible resurgence of ISIS, is worse. ISIS continues to look for new opportunities to replenish its ranks by trying to free these detained fighters, said Mr. Moss. If they escape, they will pose a threat not only to northeast Syria and the region, but to our homelands, he said. The best way to prevent this is to repatriate these individuals so they can be rehabilitated, reintegrated, and where appropriate, prosecuted. Reducing the populations in both the camps and detention centers not only make us more secure, but also makes the problem more manageable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.